Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And today we're going to begin a new series of narrations taken from The Traditions of Glastonbury by E. Raymond Capt. Glastonbury lies in the heart of Somerset County in southwest England. In early British times, Glastonbury was an island at the back of a large oozy estuary, the Uxella, covered by the waters from the Bristol Channel and drained by the rivers Axe, Parrot and the Brew. The River Brew formed a navigable river as it wound its way from the foot of the nearby Mendip Hills, north of the town of Glastonbury, to the sea just south of Bristol. Dominating the landscape is Glastonbury Tor, or Mount, rising some 500 feet, and it was once a place of Druid worship. Excavations have revealed there was a Dark Age settlement on the Mount. Imported Mediterranean pottery of the 6th century was found, among traces of wooden buildings and evidence of metalworking. The highly defensive nature of the site suggests that this may have been the chief stronghold of one Melwas, king of the Estive Regio, the summer kingdom of Somerset. Perhaps the Tor stronghold was the political centre of a much wider area than Glastonbury. During the 8th and 9th centuries AD, several small monastic communities were established on the Tor. Excavators found several tiny huts cut into the rock and a possible wooden church. Later, a Norman stone church dedicated to St. Michael the Archangel was built on the highest part of the hill. This memorial was destroyed in the earthquake that shook Glastonbury in AD 1275. All that remains today of the church is a single tower standing gaunt upon its desolate hill. The earliest name for Glastonbury was Inniswittrin in British and Glastingaberig in Anglo-Saxon, or the Glassy Island. Later, when it was found to be fruitful and ideal for the cultivation of apples, it was called Insula Avalonia, or Isle of the Apple Trees. Aval, in Welsh, means apple. Just how this area came to be known by the name of Glastonbury remains in doubt. One suggestion is that the origin of Glastonbury is in Glastingaberg, the hill fort of the Fleestings, a family who settled in the area. Another, and more accepted theory, is that the Celtic word for green is glass, and hill is tun. Glaston is therefore the green hill, so named after the tor, or mount, that dominates the landscape. When the Saxons occupied Somerset in the 6th century AD, they built a town about half a mile from the Green Hill and obtained a charter, adding Borough or Bury to the original name, which has since remained Glastonbury. The town of Glastonbury suffered incursions of the Danes in the 9th century. Later, in AD 1184, a terrible fire destroyed part of the town and the abbey. And in AD 1276, an earthquake rocked the area and destroyed St. Michael's Church on the Tor and severely damaged the town. Today, Glastonbury is a municipal borough, its charter of incorporation dating from AD 1705. The high road to the west from London passes through Bath, Wells and Glastonbury. Its ruined abbey is visited annually by the thousands of pilgrims who are drawn to its haunted vale, hallowed by the holy half-forgotten lives and reverend worship offered here from most ancient times. Although the swampy lake that surrounded the Isle of Avalon is today a grassy plain, having filled in with layers of peat, alluvial clays and gravels, many signs of the olden days still exist. Six meres, or lakes, that were formed as the estuary retreated to the sea, existed as late as the early part of the 16th century AD. Their names still show as fields on the survey maps of Somerset. one of the largest, recorded in AD 1540, as having been 5 miles in circumference, no longer exists. But the pasture fields occupying part of the site are locally known as Mere Pool. In prehistoric times, village communities flourished on the shores and the many islands that dotted this tidal swamp between Glastonbury and the sea. These village communities were inhabited by people of Celto-British or Cimmerian origin. They lived in huts of mud and wattle, a woven work of sticks intertwined with twigs or branches and thatched with reeds. The huts were more or less circular and contained stone or clay hearths in the centre. Often, the huts were washed with lime and hard woodwork of willow, alder, beech and oak. Perhaps for the sake of greater security, some of the villages were built in the shallow waters of large freshwater lakes. These were not far from the higher ground on which they grew their crops and grazed their sheep and cattle. 3 such communities were found near Glastonbury, erected or built up from platforms of stones, clay, brushwood and peat. From each community, wooden trackways ran to the mainland and nearby islands. These causeways consisted of 2 rows of pilings driven into the marsh and filled in between with layers of timbers, stone and peat. Excavations of the sites of these lake villages have provided a surprising amount of information about the inhabitants. The most noted of these excavations was at the Glastonbury Lake Village. The site of this village lies a little more than a mile from the centre of the present town of Glastonbury. Archaeological excavations found that the village covered an area of 3 to 4 acres and consisted of around 90 huts, varying from 20 to 30 feet in diameter. They were circular in shape, with a baked clay or stone-slabbed hearth in the centre. The platforms for the huts consisted of large timber logs covered with brushwood, rubble and reeds, with mortised beams binding the whole together. The walls were constructed of wattle and daub, that is, mats of woven sticks covered with clay. A layer of clay, covered with split wooden floorboards, formed the floor of the huts. There was no palisade of timbers around this village, as was found in the case of 2 older lake villages located at Mira and Godney. Glastonbury Lake Village was constructed in or around 50 BC and remained inhabited until about AD 80, when it appears to have suffered destruction by fire, perhaps from the Belgic tribes from the north. Therefore, it was in existence and inhabited during the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Its inhabitants were highly cultured and skillful in various kinds of work. Among the tools found were knives, billhooks, sickles, saws, files, awls, bolts, gouges, adzes, keys, latch lifters, and harnesses. A truly remarkable array of equipment for a workman of those days. The men of Glastonbury were obviously expert carpenters. They made dugout canoes over 20 feet long that enabled them to make long coastal trading voyages up and down the shores of the Bristol Channel, and even across the rough stretch of water to the South Wales coast. They constructed wheeled carts for transporting their crops and other loads by land. The wheels were nearly 3 feet across, with 12 spokes skillfully fitted into a strong wooden axle box. Their iron tools were well balanced, with sharply wooden handles. They created perfectly turned wooden bowls, artfully decorated in incised abstract patterns, a craft that survives unchanged in Wales today. The lake villagers produced wheel-made pottery, decorated in the characteristic flowing style of late Celtic or Latine abstract art. Their skilled glass workers produced clear glass beads decorated with inlaid coloured patterns. They even mastered the difficult art of enamelling. They worked lead from the Mendips into a variety of utensils and worked both tin and copper into small ornaments. Combining tin and copper, they produced some of the finest examples of bronze artifacts of the late Celtic period. They can hardly be distinguished from similar handmade implements fashioned by modern-day country blacksmiths. For basic subsistence, the villagers relied on a systematic and well-developed husbandry, growing wheat, barley, peas and beans, while collecting blackberries and edible seeds in season. They stored their grain in circular pits, 8 to 10 feet deep, and from 3 to 5 feet across, lined with plaited straw of reeds. They raised herds of short-horned cattle, large-horned sheep, pigs, goats and horses. They gathered wild honey, and fished with weighted nets and spears for perch, shad, trout, pike, and salmon. They hunted the deer, otter, beaver, and the wildcat. Perhaps it was the lead and copper from the nearby Mendip Hills that played an important role in the prosperity of the lake villages. The River Brew that wound its way from the village of Pilton at the foot of the Mendips through the estuary by the lake villages ended in the Bristol Channel, the passageway for trading boats. Metal, mined in the Mendips, was brought down from the hills on wooden sleds to Pilton. From there, it was loaded aboard small boats to be floated down to the channel. In those early days, the River Brew was about 9 feet deeper than it is now. The lake villages of Glastonbury would have been a natural stopover for trading. Bronze bowls and mirrors, as well as glass beads and pottery made at Glastonbury, have been found in other parts of Britain and Ireland. Glastonbury communities enjoyed their peace and prosperity in an age of ever-growing violence and strife. They undoubtedly possessed the most advanced civilization of their time in Britain. It is this period of time and place that is going to provide the beginning for our study, a study which will begin by looking at the earliest of the ancient traditions relating to the beginning of Jesus' missing years, years centering around the figure of St. Joseph of Arimathea and ending up in Glastonbury. To most Bible scholars, Joseph of Arimathea is passingly remembered as the rich man who took the body of Christ from the cross and placed it in his private sepulchre, then passing silently out of the scriptural picture soon after the ascension of Christ. The Bible indicates that Joseph, in addition to being rich, was a good man and a just man, a disciple of Jesus, and a man of social distinction and official rank, for he was an honourable counsellor. He was evidently a member of the Sanhedrin, for we are told that he had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. Joseph is always spoken of as belonging to Arimathea, which implies that it was his place of residence. Bible authorities identify this place with Ramah, or Ramala, as it is called today. It was the birthplace of the prophet Samuel, and is called in the Septuagint Arimathaeum. Being a member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph no doubt also had a residence in Jerusalem. Ancient traditions in the Eastern Church assert that Joseph was the great uncle of Jesus. This is in fact confirmed by the Jewish Talmud, which has Joseph as the younger brother of the father of Mary, and thus was her uncle and a great uncle to Jesus. The Harleian manuscripts in the British Museum, 38-59, further supports this claim that Joseph of Arimathea was uncle to the Blessed Mary. It also adds that he had a daughter, Anna, calling her consabrina, or cousin, of Mary. Other early historical manuscripts refer to Joseph as Joseph de Marmor, or Arimathea, Mar, is an Eastern term for Lord, and Mor or Mora signifies great. Thus the title would mean the great Lord Joseph of Arimathea, a title in keeping with his birth as a prince of the house of David. it is quite obvious that the husband, Joseph the widower and carpenter of Mary, died while Jesus was young. Under both Roman and Hebrew law, the next male kin automatically becomes the legal guardian of the family. In this case, it was Joseph of Arimathea. Had there been blood brothers, this duty would have passed to the eldest. The children of Mary's husband, Joseph, were by a former marriage. The term brothers and sisters in the scriptures was only one of domestic association. We also note their mother was a sister-in-law of Zechariah, making them full cousins to John the Baptist. Jeremy's Adiv Jovianum Libri II, compiled in Bethlehem, 393 AD. We also cannot overlook the fact that Joseph went in boldly unto Pilate, and Pilate gave the body to Joseph. The Sanhedrin had declared Jesus a criminal, according to both Roman and Jewish law. Unless the body of an executed criminal was immediately claimed by the next of kin, the body of the victim was cast into a common pit, where, as with others, all physical record of them was completely obliterated. Certainly, the fanatical Sadducean element of the Sanhedrin, who sought the total extinction of Jesus, even in death, would have allowed nothing short of a legal claim on the body of Christ. Joseph of Arimathea was a man whom the Sadducees dared not oppose. His influence was so great, it stretched beyond the borders of Judea, into the high places of Roman authority. The hatred of the Sadducees towards Joseph must have been surpassed only by their hatred of Jesus. It was Joseph who, on at least one occasion, defended Jesus before the Sanhedrin. Throughout the trial, Jesus offered no defence, knowing beforehand that he was destined to die. There is reason to believe that Joseph of Arimathea was not present at the final trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. Being aware of the mystery of the birth of Jesus, Joseph must have been aware of his destiny. Joseph believed in the validity of all Jesus taught and ultimately suffered for. Gospel of Nicodemus, chapter 9. It is also possible that Christ himself asked Joseph not to appear in his defence. Joseph's presence might have delayed the inevitable appointment with the cross. Although Matthew and Mark declared that all the chief priests and elders and the whole council was present at the morning trial, it is possible they were employing a figure of speech, a synecdoche, a figure of speech in which a part or individual is used for a whole or class, or the reverse of this, when they said that all the council was present. A number of arguments have been offered to indicate that more than one of the members of the Sanhedrin were absent at the morning trial of Jesus. There were two distinct trials, one between 2 and 3 a.m. Friday, which is recorded by Matthew 5 and Mark 6, and a second, about daybreak of the same day, recorded by Matthew 7, Mark 8, and Luke 9. In the first place, at a previous meeting of the Sanhedrin, it has been said, Nicodemus, a Pharisee by profession and a member of the Sanhedrin, defended Jesus by asking his fellow judges this question: Doth our law judge any man before it hear him, and know what he doeth? There is no good reason to believe that Nicodemus defended Jesus at this meeting, and then turned against him on a subsequent one. This would also be true of Joseph of Arimathea, who had not consented to the council and deed of them. The trial of Jesus was held in illegal session, and in breach of Roman law, as well as Hebrew law. The Roman law did not permit court hearings to be held after sunset, and the Hebrew law forbid a trial for life, since this was the exclusive prerogative of the Roman courts, and to be held only before the Roman procurator. Yet Caiaphas, high priest of the Sanhedrin, ordered and presided over the trial of Jesus, in which the death penalty was demanded. Recognizing that only Roman authority could impose a death sentence, Caiaphas demanded that Jesus be tried before Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator of the Roman province of Palestine, on the charge of treason. It is quite possible Joseph pleaded with Pilate on Jesus' behalf. Four times Pilate pronounced Jesus innocent of all charges, yet in the tangle of politics and intrigue, Jesus was condemned and executed as a common criminal. His body was placed in the tomb which Joseph had provided for himself within the confines of his garden or orchard at Jerusalem. Joseph continued to hold his membership in the Sanhedrin until the year 36 AD. Strangely, the Bible has nothing further to say about Joseph of Arimathea following the crucifixion. Surely this man, who was a disciple of Jesus, who had shown rare courage in begging the body of Jesus, would have become a close follower of Christ after the transforming experience at Pentecost. The Bible never mentions him again, yet we are not left in the dark concerning the dominant role Joseph played in the spreading of Christianity. Joseph became the apostle of Britain, who with 12 other disciples of Christ, including his son Josephus and Mary, the mother of Jesus, established Christianity in the Isles of Britain over 500 years before St. Augustine set foot on English soil. Several ancient manuscripts indicate that after the Passion of Christ, Joseph of Arimathea was commissioned by St. Philip the Apostle to take the gospel to Britain. One such manuscript is the Victory of Aurelius Ambrosius by Gildas Albanicus. It asserts plainly that Britain received the gospel in the time of Emperor Tiberius, and that Joseph was sent, with others, after the dispersion of the disciples, to Britain by St. Philip. There, Joseph was to lay the foundation of the Christian religion. The author gives the date, about the year of our Lord 63, and he adds that Joseph stayed in Britain the rest of his life. Another manuscript, De Antiquities of Glastonbury, 1908, contains this entry in the opening chapter. St. Philip, coming into the country of the Franks to preach, converted to the faith and baptized them. Working to spread Christ's word, he chose 12 from among his disciples and sent them into Britain. Their leader, it was said, was Philip's dearest friend, Joseph of Arimathea, who buried the Lord. And that's translated from De Antiquiti Glastambiensis Ecclesia from 1240. Hugh Paulinus Creasy, the English Catholic Benedictine, 1605-1674, in his Church History of England, describes Britain as receiving the beams of the Sun of Righteousness before many other countries nearer approaching the place where he first rose. Book 1, Chapter 5. Now, the most eminent of the primitive disciples and who contributed most to this heavenly building was Saint Joseph of Arimathea, and 11 of his companions with him, among whom is reckoned his son of his own name. These, toward the latter end of Nero's reign, and before St. Peter and St. Paul were consummated by a glorious martyrdom, are, by the testimony of ancient records, said to have entered this island as a place for the retiredness of it, the benignity to the British princes, and the freedom from Roman tyranny, more opportune and better prepared for entertaining the gospel of peace than almost any country under the Romans. Book 2, Chapter 1. Gildas Badonicus, AD 516-570, the earliest British historian, refers to Joseph of Arimathea as Nobilis Decurio. The same title, Decurio, is used by St. Jerome in his translation of the Vulgate of St. Mark's Honourable Counsellor. and St. Luke's councillor. In the Roman world, Aedo Curio denoted an important Roman office, usually connected with the general management of a mining district. The implication is that Joseph was a provincial Roman senator and in charge of Rome's mining interests, perhaps in Britain. Such a position would require Joseph to spend a considerable amount of time away from his homeland. This would also account for the reason the evangelists had so little to say about him. He was busy in the metal trade in Britain.